This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Going to space and on a SpaceX Dragon capsule and being the mission pilot is the most rewarding and inspiring thing I could ever think of.
That was American astronaut Sian Proctor, currently touring South African schools and inspiring students to pursue careers in the sciences. Details coming up. Also, who are Kenya's Gen Z protesters? And there was a plot, Iranian plot, to kill former U.S. President Donald Trump. Details on these stories and more coming up. But first, our top story. The recent protests in Kenya that forced the president to dissolve his cabinet has been led by people under 27 years old, members of the so-called Generation Z, many of whom identify as tribalist and classless. The nationwide protests are largely organized on social media with no notable leaders. They have snowballed into a movement calling for good governance with broad backing across Kenya. So who are these Gen Z protesters? Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
These have been the scenes in the streets of Nairobi and across Kenya for the past 2 months. Young people leading demonstrations to call for good governance. Government data show about 3/4 of Kenya's population is under 35 years old. Wanjiru Gikonyo is an expert on what she calls transformative governance in Nairobi.
And what they said is they realize there is no one to speak for them.
Most of the protesters are part of Generation Z, born in 1997 and later. Their protests were sparked by a contentious tax bill that President William Ruto later withdrew. But protesters say the president has to step down as well. 26-year-old Kasmuel Mark Oure has been in the forefront of the protests. He says the Ruto must go call is not an attack on Ruto personally, but a call for good governance.
It is the Ruto-isms, the isms that have been associated with him, the corruption that bedevils his government, the cronyism, the sheer incompetence of the people who surround him in government, the sheer number of unconstitutional offices that we've had to endure in his tenure, the extrajudicial killings, the excesses of the police, in a country where we live and where we have a police force and not a police service. Ruto Must Go is a clarion call to a better Kenya.
Ruto dissolved his cabinet on July 11 and reconstituted it to include members of the main opposition party. Speaking last week in Mombasa County, he pledged to tackle the main accusation against his government.
I will mobilize resources that are available. I will mobilize every resource that is available to deal with the challenge of corruption.
But critics say the new cabinet, which has half of the fired ministers back in office, does not inspire hope. Recent polls show over 80% of Kenyans support the youth-led protests. Wanjiru says this is because the protesters spoke to the feelings of many Kenyans.
Kenya is in a bad situation. Our political leaders do not reflect our aspirations. And the young people have come and spoken to our aspirations. So really what we are seeing by these shop owners and business owners and parents who are supporting their young people is these young people have captured our aspiration.
Analysts say to bring about real change, the youth-led movement has to organize politically and collaborate with other progressive political groups. Protester Leon Mushiri agrees.
It's high time the young people come together and say that we have identified certain individuals from all over the 47 counties, and we have come together and we're saying that this is the opportunity for us also to go on the ballot come 2027.
President Ruto says the government will not allow further protests in the country, saying, quote, enough is enough. But activists note the right to peaceful protest is guaranteed in the constitution, and protesters like Mark Oure are defiant. They are planning a major demonstration in Nairobi on August 8th. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
VOA will have coverage of the planned protests in Nairobi tomorrow. The government has warned organizers of the so-called Nani Nani movement to keep demonstrations peaceful and safe. You can find the latest on developments in Kenya on voaafrica.com. American astronaut, geoscience professor and artist Sian Proctor is touring South African schools to emphasize the importance of education in science, technology, engineering, art and mathematics. Her goal is to inspire students to pursue careers in the science and equip them for space jobs. Zahir Kasim reports from Johannesburg.
Sian Proctor always dreamed of being an astronaut. In 2009, she became a finalist for the U.S. space agency NASA astronaut program, but didn't get the job. Proctor, a geology professor and artist, never gave up on her space dreams. In 2021, she was chosen to participate in SpaceX's Inspiration 4, the first all-civilian orbital mission. She became the first black woman to pilot spacecraft.
Going to space and on a SpaceX Dragon capsule and being the mission pilot is the most rewarding and inspiring thing I could ever think of. To be able to say that I'm a Dragon flyer, and for, you know, girls and women of color to see me and know that if I did it, they could do it too.
Late last month, she was in Johannesburg, South Africa, speaking to over 250 high school students about the importance of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM, when pursuing a profession in space exploration. She says another subject is also crucial for would-be astronauts.
My art in space project.
But we got to add the arts in because that's the creative side. You can't have science without creativity and imagination because that's where the innovation comes. And so it's really important that we inspire, prepare, and eventually employ students to go into these areas.
The space sector is expanding rapidly, yet companies face challenges in recruiting due to the high demand for STEM skills. Space agencies in the United States, United Kingdom, and South Africa have all reported a shortage of qualified personnel. Exposure to real-life role models can help address this issue, says Steve Sherman, head of the education nonprofit Living Maths, which helped arrange Proctor's visit.
We want them to know how exciting a career can be if they interact with these people who actually use math and science and technology in their careers. If they can see how awesome it is, then hopefully they'll be more engaged.
Many in the country don't know space careers exist, says South African National Space Agency educator Ntabiseng Lebaka.
I had no idea that South Africa has a space agency. They were looking for a science educator. So I'm currently working as a science engagement officer, where we do outreach programs, we do space clubs, we also do teacher development training as well.
Proctor then took a mission to Cape Town, where she shares her inspirational journey to promote education in STEM subjects and the arts.
Space to inspire!
Sayur Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
South Africa's security industry regulatory body says that a camp where 95 Libyans were detained last month is illegal because it provided military-style training to people from a country in conflict. The Libyans have been detained since July 26, when police raided the training camp about 360 kilometers east of Johannesburg. The French news agency AFP reports that the company running the facility was registered with the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority, but the camp where the Libyans were found was not accredited. An investigation found that some of the instructors were not South Africans and the standards of training that was offered was foreign or adapted from other countries. Libya has suffered insecurity since the overthrow of former leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. A faction led by Khalifa Haftar controls the oil-rich east of the country, while the Government of National Agreement controls most of the rest of the country. The head of the company running the camp has denied allegations the camp has violated the law. The Tuareg-led separatists in northern Mali say they killed 84 Wagner fighters and 47 Malian soldiers in fighting late last month at a military camp in Tinza Oteni near the Algerian border. The separatist alliance said that they took 7 Wagner and Malian government fighters hostage and lost 9 men in the clashes. Some regional security analysts say it was the heaviest loss suffered by the Wagner in Africa. Wolfgang Porstai, a senior advisor at Austrian Institute for European Security Policy, discussed this with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Altogether, from 2013 to 2022, in 9 years of French involvement in the war in Mali, altogether 59 French soldiers were killed, while the terrorists and the insurgent activities were more or less under control. So this means that alone in this battle, the Russians have lost more soldiers without a success than the French in 9 years. Obviously, there is a lack of efficiency of the Russian mercenary operation. This is probably due to a lack of rapidly available air support in the case of an emergency, a lack of helicopters to transport reserves, and of an efficient quick reaction force, and especially a lack of in-depth intelligence. It was already known before that the Russian mercenaries do not have the sophisticated intelligence assets that the French and the Americans have on hand. But it seems to be there is also a lack of operational planning capabilities and tactical leadership on side of the Russians. The aim of this Russian Mali operation was to take control of the border town Tinza Oteni and to cut off the rebels' supply routes from Algeria far in the hinterland. And after this disaster, it can be assumed that the Russians and the Mali government will operate much more carefully in the future.
But even before the latest death toll claimed by the Tuareg-led separatists, the losses appear to be Wagner's heaviest defeat since its step in 2 years ago to help Mali's military authorities fight groups that have been waging insurgencies since 2012. What does that mean for the Russian mercenaries in Mali and elsewhere in Africa?
This is a very important development. Actually, it's a serious blow, a very serious blow to the reputation of the Russian mercenaries and the morale, as well as to the morale of the local allies. In a region where reputation and perceptions of capabilities are very important for fighting and succeeding in a war, and especially for getting the trust of the locals, this is really a tremendous negative propaganda for the Russians. Furthermore, also back home in Russia, it might now also be much more difficult to recruit new mercenaries for the fight in Africa. Certainly, many young men are scared of falling alive in the hands of the rebels of the Tuareg in Mali or elsewhere in the Sahel zone, knowing that the leadership can't do much to free them. And probably most important is that this will undermine the trust of the various military regimes in the region, not only in Mali, but also in Niger, in Burkina Faso, and further on, into the capabilities of the Russians. So this might have a really long-term impact. In Mali particularly, the government and the Russians will need to rethink their strategy against the various terrorist and insurgent groups, especially with regard to their goal of regaining control of the north.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had spoken with Malian counterpart and expressed Russia's firm intention to continue rendering the necessary support. Ukraine has emerged as a key player in the conflict between Malian military, Russian mercenaries, and the Tuareg rebels because a senior Ukrainian intelligence official recently claimed that Ukraine provided crucial intelligence to the rebels, leading to a military operation that killed Malian soldiers and Russian mercenaries. Your thoughts on that?
Keeping the significance of Africa for Russia's global strategy in mind, Moscow will do everything to overcome this setback. Lavrov's recent statement must be also seen in this context. The mercenary operations in Africa are an important tool in Russia's struggle against the West, in particular about gaining access to the vast natural resources in the region and in turn denying this access to the West. Therefore, it can be expected that after an in-depth analysis of this defeat, Moscow will deploy even more mercenaries and surveillance assets, including drones, to Mali. With regard to Ukraine, it seems to be that Ukrainian intelligence support was really very valuable for the Tuareg, because after this massacre, the government of Mali has severed diplomatic ties with Ukraine. I would say Ukraine is certainly able to provide lots of intelligence about Russian tactics, their weapons and equipment, including about weak points. But with regard to actionable intelligence on Russian mercenary operations, I'm not so sure. However, it might be possible that they are even able to provide such concrete intelligence by means of signal intelligence and human intelligence.
That was Wolfgang Poschta, a senior advisor at the Austrian Institute for European Security Policy, talking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The U.S. says it will provide nearly $414 million in humanitarian assistance for the Democratic Republic of Congo, where more than 25 million people need help, nearly a quarter of the country's population. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Agencies for Food and Agriculture, Jeffrey Prescott, told Reuters News a significant amount of that money would go to U.N. agencies and aid groups providing urgent food assistance, health care and nutritional support, shelter, water, sanitation and hygiene. Prescott says the funding also includes support for agricultural commodities from American farmers. He says the total U.S. funding for DRC since October is $838 million. An Iranian plot to kill former U.S. President Donald Trump appears to have centered on a Pakistani man with ties to Tehran who hoped to also target other high-profile politicians and officials. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has more.
Charging documents unsealed Tuesday say 46-year-old Asif Merchant spent 2 weeks in Iran before flying to the United States in April looking for help to target multiple government officials and politicians. The plan, according to prosecutors, had three parts: steal documents or computer files from the target's home, plan protests, and then kill the targets on U.S. soil. The White House declined to comment on specifics of the case, but said countering the danger posed by Iran has been a top priority.
We have said many times that we have been tracking Iranian threats against former politicians. We've been very clear about that.
Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says many of the threats have been linked to Iran's desire to get revenge for a 2020 U.S. airstrike in Baghdad that killed Qasem Soleimani, a key Iranian military commander.
We have invested extraordinary resources in developing additional information about these threats, disrupting individuals involved in these threats, enhancing protective arrangements and potential targets of these threats, engaging with foreign partners, and directly warning Iran.
When contacted by VOA, the suspect's court-appointed lawyer declined comment. But court documents say Merchant told an informant he can make up to $100,000 and that he paid two undercover officers posing as hitmen a $5,000 advance. And while the papers never identify which U.S. officials were on Merchant's hit list, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee said in a statement that this case was the one that prompted the U.S. Secret Service to enhance security for former President Donald Trump. U.S. officials arrested Merchant July 12th, a day before an unrelated assassination attempt targeting Trump during a campaign rally in western Pennsylvania. Even with Merchant in custody, however, some analysts are bracing for more.
Much like Iranian projectiles, sometimes quantity has a quality of its own.
The Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Benim Ben Talablu, points to previous Iranian plots targeting former U.S. National Security Advisor Ambassador John Bolton, Iranian dissidents, and others.
On the one hand, some of these things may sound cartoonish or too far-fetched, but on the other hand, there's a persistence behind it, which is worrisome.
Top U.S. officials agree, the FBI director telling lawmakers just last month, quote, "I expect there will be more coming." Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
time now for our Olympic Roundup. And VOA sports analyst and host of our Olympic podcast, Chasing Gold, Mokbil Yabaro, is in studio. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Yehaya.
So the men's 5,000 meters had a lot of drama, Mokbil. Can you fill us on what happened?
Interestingly enough, you know, what we saw in the 5,000 meters for the women as well seems to have happened here again. No disqualifications, but there was some contact and there was some of the runners that ended up falling. There was a collision that occurred in both heats one and two. Spain's Thierry Dicuinao. And he basically ended up falling, and several other runners ended up falling along with him in that 5,000-meter race. We had Somali Abdelhamid Nour, who I actually interviewed a little while ago. He also slipped and fell. You know, unfortunately for him, he was expected to be able to make it to the finals to compete in that 5,000-meter final tomorrow. But unfortunately, he didn't make it. Still young enough that, you know, he can come back again for the next Olympics. There's always another opportunity.
Lots of pushing and shoving.
Yes.
The Nigerian women's basketball team, Mokbil, will play the U.S. later on today. Any predictions?
Ooh, yes. This is exciting, exciting, simply because these are two completely different playing styles for both these teams. When you look at the U.S. team, you think these are the most elite women that are playing in the game of basketball. Similarly, how the game of basketball was for the men's years ago with Jordan and the likes in 92, where the game was getting globalized. So with that being said, their skill set seems to be more offensive-minded for the U.S. team, whereas the Nigerian team has mainly been concentrating on defense. They have been swarming teams. They have been blocking. They have been stealing the ball. All of these different things that they've been doing has made it very, very difficult for teams to go up against them. So I'm very interested to see how they go up against each other. Another funny and interesting fact is we have a player by the name of Arike Agunbowale, and she is a Nigerian-American WNBA star. She's been in the league for about five years now. She was supposed to, she was going to be selected for the U.S. team, but for whatever reason, you know, we don't really know exactly what happened on why she opted not to play for the U.S. team. This go-around, she has played for the U.S. in the past. She actually wanted to play for the Nigerian team. But when you play for a senior team on a Olympic level or a world's level, you cannot go and play like dual citizenship. So basically, since she's already played for the U.S. team, her team appealed and tried to play for the Nigerian team. She unfortunately was not able to. Had she been able to do it so, though, this Nigerian team would have so much more firepower because she was the WNBA All-Star MVP this year.
Last but not least, the Algerian boxer, Imani Khalif, will be competing in the women's 66 kg finals on Friday. She had quite the storyline on these Olympics. Can you tell us more about
that? Yeah, absolutely. Yes, there's been a trending topic on social media as Imani Khalif from Algeria defeated Angela Carini, the Italian, with two punches, right? Angela, the Italian, came out and said that these are the two strongest punches she's ever felt. Yeah, and then what ended up happening is people started doing some research and seeing that Imani actually was born with higher elevated levels of testosterone in her body. People may have thought that she was either transgendered. So this kind of conversation happened. But as she is still competing in the Olympics, the Olympic body has said that she was born a woman and should still compete for gold. She will be fighting, she will be boxing against Liu Yang for the finals. Potentially, she can get a gold for Algeria.
Our VOA sports analyst and host of our Olympics podcast, Chasing Gold, Mokbil Yabaro, thank you for your input.
Thanks.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehaya Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our engineer, Bob Bass, thank you for listening to the Voice of America.